Hello, today we're here with Mr. Singh, one of the paediatric surgery consultants in Nottingham. He's an international man of mystery, well-travelled. Today we'll just be going through the topic of gastroschisis and just going through the how it's investigated, how it's managed, and different factors to consider with this condition. So first of all, Mr. Singh, would you be able to kick us off just by telling us what exactly gastroschisis is?
Gastroschisis is a congenital abdominal wall defect where there is a defect in the abdominal wall approximately 1 to 3 centimeters in size. 99% of the time it is to the right side of the umbilicus through which entire midgut comes out. So that is called gastroschisis. It has to be distinguished from eczemphalos or omphalocele, because in eczemphalos and omphalocele the umbilicus is absent. There is a defect in the middle of the abdominal wall, but the contents of the abdominal cavity are covered with a membrane, which has got 3 layers, and we'll talk it separately.
And are there any things in particular that would predispose to someone getting a gastroschisis?
We still don't know the exact predisposing factors, although we know that it is usually seen in younger age group, usually in the women or the girls of the age group of 17 to 21. Or some of them who have been on any drugs. The incidence is certainly increasing, but we don't know the cause for that.
Okay. And how would these babies normally present?
These babies are most of the time these days picked on the antenatal scans, which are usually done at 18 weeks of gestation.
And how would it look when you're doing these scans?
On the scans, you can see that there is a well-developed umbilical stalk, and then there's a defect in the abdominal wall to the right of the stalk, and of the entire of the intestine is floating in the amniotic cavity like a cauliflower.
Okay, and so what are some of the issues that would be surrounding antenatal counseling?
While doing the antenatal counseling, especially in these days with the current literature, you have to tell the mother that the survival of all the patients with gastroschisis is more than 90% in developed countries. More than 85 to 90% will have excellent long-term outcome. This is despite prolonged postnatal hospital stay and period of dependence of TPN while waiting bowel function. However, you have to warn the mother and the father or the partner about the major risk factors for the adverse outcome of an antenatally diagnosed gastroschisis. And these are in the complex gastroschisis, which is defined by a presence of bowel atresia or necrosis or perforation of the intestine or a volvulus or a short bowel syndrome from various causes. Now, these complications, which we put in the category of complex gastroschisis, they happen in 10 to 20% of the babies with gastroschisis. And it is the existence of the short bowel syndrome which significantly worsens the long-term outcome of this abnormality. And you have to mention to the parents that a PICC line or a central line will be required for at least 3 to 6 weeks.
And that's just because the guts, even if they don't have an atresia, just take a little bit of a while to get going. Is that right?
Yes. The gut at least take minimum 3 weeks to function.
And so obviously these aren't the most straightforward babies to be delivering. So what would be your approach to managing that aspect?
Yeah. Now, the mode of delivery is decided by the obstetrician based on the obstetric indications. Coming to the timing, early delivery may be indicated for specific fetal finding, such as an evidence of bowel perforation or a closing gastroschisis, which we'll talk later. Now, bowel perforation may be suggested by an antenatal scan showing the bowel loops which are collapsed, which were previously dilated, and appearance of new particulate matter in the amniotic fluid. And if you are suspecting a perforation, then amniocentesis is indicated, which confirms a meconium in the amniotic fluid, which is suggestive of intrauterine perforation of the gastroschisis, and this warrants urgent delivery.
Okay. What would be the initial management? So once they've been delivered, how would you manage them?
Yeah.
Surgically.
Now, there are two characteristic features that determine the initial care. And those two characteristic features are that most of the babies with the gastroesophageal cases are premature and low birth weight. And the second is that because of the intestine protruding outside the abdominal cavity and not covered by any membrane, so there is a large surface area of the intestine which is exposed, and this increases the risk of hypothermia and increased fluid loss. So in order to manage this risk of hypothermia and increased fluid loss, the best way to control this problem is to place the most of the infant in a plastic down drawstring bag, so that the gastroesophageal and the lower extremities are all covered in the same bag, and this will decrease the risk of hypothermia and also the fluid loss. Now, one thing which has to be very careful is that the neonate should be positioned on the right side and not on the left side. The reason it is positioned on the right side is to prevent the kinking of the mesentery of extruded bowel to prevent any ischemia, because the defect is to the right of the umbilicus. Now, the common sense demands that because of increased fluid loss, you should give more fluid. But recent evidence suggests that excessive fluid resuscitation is detrimental and the results in edema and an increase in the time to closure and increased risk of compartment syndrome. So you just give the maintenance fluid, but you prevent the hypothermia. The other factor is that the faster the intestine can be returned to the abdominal cavity, the more is the chances of primary closure. So a minimum time should be spent in the neonatal unit for resuscitation, and the child should be wheeled to the operating theater. The sooner, the better.
And so once you're in the operating theater, what would be the sort of plan of action then? Because I understand there are things like silos, and then some people would just close them straight away. What would be the different components that would change your decision?
Good question. There are some centers who close the gastroschisis primarily in the neonatal unit. And this technique was proposed by Mr. Bianchi from Manchester, and it is still being practiced quite a bit in the world. And then there is a technique developed by the Sheffield where these gastroschisis are managed in the neonatal by simply putting a silo rather than attempting a primary closure. But most of the centers and the traditional way is to shift the child to the operating theater and attempt a primary closure on the operating table. And if the primary closure is not possible for reasons where there is a disproportionate amount of intestinal volume compared to the abdominal cavity, then you put a silo and go for the secondary closure. However, putting the silo, whether you put it in the neonatal unit or you put it in the operating theater, there are two precautions and cautions you have to take. One is any bands crossing the bowel loop should be lysed before the silo is placement, because otherwise they'll cause any obstruction. And second, and the most important, is that most of the silos which we place, they are spring loaded. So you must put the inferior part of the silo towards the urinary bladder first, and be very careful to put the upper end should be taken to place the liver end gently, and then the lower end towards the urinary bladder. And this is to avoid spring action damaging the hepatic veins. And thirdly, you look for any intestinal atresia.
Okay. And so how would an intestinal atresia change your management for these patients?
Yeah. Intestinal atresias in gastroesophageal cases can be of two categories. One is a simple atresias, and other is the atresias which are associated with volvulus, necrosis, or perforation. So let's talk first about the simple atresias. So if you find a simple atresia, and the bowel is not matted, and there is not much discrepancy between the dilated and the non-dilated segment of the intestine, then you can attempt a primary anastomosis. However, if you have a simple atresia, but the bowel wall is very thickened and matted, or there is too much discrepancy between the diameter of the intestine, then you don't attempt a repair of intestinal atresia. You leave the atresia alone. You close the gastroschisis, and then you do another laparotomy after 4 to 6 weeks to repair the atresia, because by that time, the thickening and matting of the intestine has disappeared. Coming to the atresia with volvulus, necrosis, and perforation, this is the category which requires a resection of bowel, and most of the time, you end up doing an end ileostomy, with or without a feeding gastrostomy. Most of the people don't do feeding gastrostomy. And in very rare cases where you can attempt a primary anastomosis, but for most practical purposes, an ileostomy is the choice.
And so when it comes to closing the gastroschisis, what does that involve?
Closing the gastroschisis, you have closed the gastroschisis. The one of the main thing which you have to worry in the post-operative period is the compartment syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Because closing the gastroschisis is like putting a 2 kilogram of sugar into a 1 kilogram bag. So if there is a compartment syndrome, it is going to have effect on the lower extremity venous return and the renal perfusion, and that can lead to ischemia of the intestine. So how do you diagnose this? First is the suspicion. If your ventilatory parameters are such that you have to ventilate the child with a very high mean airway pressure, or you have to give a lot of PEEP, that is one. Two, there will be edema or duskiness of the lower extremities. Three, a decreasing urine output. And then how do you confirm that? One of the simple thing is that if you have a line in the lower extremity, which really you should not, but if you have it, and if it is in the saphenous vein, and if it does not drip by gravity, that is very, very suggestive of a compartment syndrome. Other is a measurement of intravesical or intragastric pressure. And if it is more than 20 centimeters of water, it is suggestive of compartment syndrome. And the third, but the most important, is a splanchnic perfusion pressure. What is splanchnic perfusion pressure? It is mean arterial pressure minus intra-abdominal pressure. The intra-abdominal pressure being measured either intravesical or intragastric. And if it is less than 44 millimeter of mercury, it implies that there is decreased intestinal blood flow. And these are the cases where you should take them either to operating theater or in the neonatal unit, open the gastroschisis repair and exteriorize the intestine, because otherwise you will have a gangrene of the entire intestine.
And that would be a problem with exomphalos as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The same sort of principles apply.
Yeah, same principles apply with the closure following exomphalos, if it is a major exomphalos, and the same clinical as well as the pressure parameters which need to be applied.
Another term that I've heard before called vanishing gastroschisis. So what does that mean exactly?
So vanishing gastroschisis means you have a strangulated gastroschisis due to the in utero closure of the defect. This abnormality also presents with a wide spectrum of findings, but typically results in bowel atresia proximally and distally with severe ischemia and necrosis of the bowel, and it invariably leads to short bowel syndrome. It can be suspected prenatally, and the way to suspect prenatally is that the intra-abdominal bowel loops are dilated, but the loops which are lying outside the abdomen of the fetus, they could be shrinking and the extra-abdominal mass could be disappearing. And this is one of the indications for early delivery to facilitate salvage of the intestine from an impending catastrophe. It is rare, but one has to be aware of it.
Thank you so much for your time. We'll go through exomphalos as well in our next podcast. So yeah, thank you for your time, Mr. Singh.
Thank you.
Look forward to the next one.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another podcast brought to you by School of Surgery. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at School of Surgery, on iTunes, on Podomatic at schoolofsurgery.podomatic.com, and finally, by searching School of Surgery on YouTube. Thank you very much, and see you next time.